It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Do we as American citizens have a right to vote in elections? In practice, it seems like we do. But take a look at the U.S. Constitution. Look for a line like this. Any person who has attained the age of 18 shall be entitled to vote. You won't find it there because that's from the basic law in Germany. And you won't really find any basic guarantee of a right to vote in the U.S. Constitution. Our next guest says the absence of a constitutionally defined positive right to vote is a big problem that leads to a lot of our debates about voting laws in the U.S. today. And he says we need a constitutional amendment to fix that problem. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Should the U.S. Constitution be amended to guarantee a right to vote? Do you have questions about how that could work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Richard Hassan is a law professor at UCLA. His latest book is A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back with you.
Rick, people might be surprised. We assume we have a right to vote, but the Constitution doesn't really lay that out in plain terms.
That's right. If you go back to the original Constitution, state legislatures chose presidential electors. State legislatures chose senators. That didn't change until the 20th century with the 17th Amendment passage. And as to the House of Representatives, it said, yeah, we're going to have an election, but who can vote in that election is up to the states to decide on qualifications. And over time, we've amended the Constitution to prevent certain forms of discrimination, like on the basis of gender or race. But we've never said that there is an affirmative right to vote. And as recently as 2000, in the Bush versus Gore case that ended the dispute over the 2000 election and the Florida's Electoral College votes, the Supreme Court said state legislatures could take back for future elections the ability to choose electors themselves. And we don't have a right to vote for president.
But people might say, okay, no big deal. In practice, we keep expanding the franchise to more and more people over time. We have this presumption that we're going to do things in elections. Courts will save us from those rights being infringed. So no harm there. You tackle that objection in your book. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say over time, the courts have not been the great protector of voting rights. So I tell some stories in the book. For example, in 1874, a woman named Virginia Minor went to the Supreme Court and said, I'm a citizen adult resident. They're not letting me vote in Missouri because I'm a woman. And the 14th Amendment guarantees me in the Constitution the privileges or immunities of citizenship. And the Supreme Court said, sorry, you are a citizen, but that's not a privilege or immunity of citizenship. That's a question of state law. Similarly, or even worse, in 1903, a man named Jackson Giles went to the Supreme Court and said, Alabama's not letting me vote, even though I'm an adult citizen male. Why can't I vote? And it was because he was black and they wouldn't register him. And the Supreme Court said, even though there was a 15th Amendment, sorry, we're not going to enforce that. It wasn't until Congress passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965 that we had effective representation for black voters in the South and in other parts of the country. Throughout time, it's been a struggle. It hasn't been a constant expansion of enfranchisement. And even today, there are lots of pockets of people who face barriers to voting that really are not justified. And so one of the things the amendment would do is it would affirmatively state that we have these rights, and especially because the Supreme Court may no longer recognize some of the rights to vote that it did earlier during the period that we refer to as the Warren Court in the 1960s.
Let's dive into the amendments that you're proposing, suggesting. You've got a couple different versions. I want to start with the clean one that focuses really straightforwardly on saying, hey, yes, you have a constitutional right to vote. You've got it broken into six parts. What are the key elements that you would want to see in an amendment like that?
Sure. And I should say before I go through each part that I've got three goals. One is to assure political equality, the idea that all of us who are eligible to vote should have an equal chance to vote. Second, we have too much election litigation. This is something that you in Wisconsin know all too well. My amendment would lower the amount of election litigation and the risk of stolen elections, of election subversion. There are things we can do to make it harder to protect our democracy. So what do I do? First and foremost, every citizen, adult, resident, non-felon would have the right to vote for president and for other offices. Those votes would be equally weighted. when states impose burdens on voting or on registration, they'd have to come up with good reasons. It would change how the courts do the balancing in those cases to put a thumb on the scale favoring voters. I would also direct the Supreme Court and lower courts to be more deferential to Congress when they expand voting rights. And I would require registration of all eligible voters, coupled with a national kind of identification, which would eliminate a lot of litigation, ensure our elections are being done fairly and with integrity. And finally, I would enshrine in part of the Const I would enshrine this constitutional amendment, part of the Voting Rights Act that protects minority voters and assures that they have a fair chance to be able to elect a candidate of their choice.
Talking to Rick Hassan about his new book, A Real Right to Vote: How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. You could join in with your thoughts on his idea, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Okay, people might say, hey, I find it as a citizen pretty easy to register to vote now. Okay, yeah, we've got a voter ID in Wisconsin. That's a little bit of a hurdle, but not a big deal. What would you say to people who say, you know, I don't think I'd see much difference under that basic guarantee of a right to vote?
Well, it may be that for a particular person, if they're lucky enough to live in the right place where they have the right ID, or they live in the place where they don't face a particular barrier, then it's not a big deal for them. And I would say we should worry about others. And I give some examples. For example, I talk about how in North Dakota, the state legislature, seeing that Native American voters were supporting Heidi Heitkamp, the Democrat who was a U.S. senator from the area, imposed a residential address requirement in order to vote. Now, for most people, producing your residential address, saying you live at 123 Main Street, is, of course, the easiest thing in the world. But if you're poor and Native American and you live on a reservation, it turned out to be a big hurdle. Well, that could affect the outcome of an election. And more importantly, why should these voters who are otherwise eligible to vote be disenfranchised because they don't have a street address, because they're, you know, too poor to live in an area where they've developed street addresses? So that's one answer. And the other answer is some of the guarantees that we have are the product of Supreme Court decisions that this current Supreme Court might at some point overturn. One of the early stories I tell in the book is about a Texas constitutional provision that disenfranchised members of the military. It said if you were not a Texas resident before you joined the military, you were not allowed to vote in Texas elections. Texas said, we want to say voting for people who lived here longer, who are not part of the military. The military voters could swamp our elections. And this case, the plaintiff, Sergeant Herbert Carrington, had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to get the right to vote. And so today your right to vote may be secure, but who knows what the future would be? All of us should have a right to vote affirmatively protected in the United States Constitution.
I want to dig into another part of your amendment, Rick, the equal weighting of votes. And I'm sure you know, big issue here in Wisconsin, redistricting, gerrymandering, things like that. Something I didn't know before I read your book, the requirement that each district in a state legislature or congressional district has to be roughly the same population, it has not always been that way. And you point out we could go back to the old way, skewing votes. Could you talk about the importance of that part of your proposed amendment?
Sure. Well, you know, before the decisions by the Supreme Court in the 1960s, we had some wildly unequal voting. So, for example, where I am in California, the largest and smallest counties in the state had the same representation in our state Senate. What I tell my students is we're going to hold an election on what the form of our final exam will be, have 50 students in the class. They each get one vote and I get 100 votes. So we could hold that election. They wouldn't be disenfranchised because they'd all get to vote, but my vote would be determinative. It's the same kind of thing if you don't have equal weighting of votes. And so again, today we have equal weighting of votes thanks to some decisions, including famously Reynolds versus Sims and Baker versus Carr. These are Supreme Court cases from the 1960s, but I'm not convinced that the current Supreme Court would necessarily uphold those if they were challenged. And so why not put it in the Constitution itself?
Another part of the resolution, the amendment you suggest, has to do with the balance of power between the Supreme Court and Congress. Now, with the 13th to 15th Amendments, the ones after the Civil War, they all end with something like Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. The Supreme Court over the years, in many cases, ruled that Congress does not, in fact, have that power. Can you talk about how the balance of power, as you see it, has gone out of whack when it comes to enforcing federal election laws?
Well, so there are both cases about Congress's power, and there are cases about state power. So when it comes to Congress's power, the most important recent case is Shelby County versus Holder. That's where the Supreme Court said that the part of the Voting Rights Act that required jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination in voting to get federal approval and show that their laws would not make minority voters worse off, that this provision that had been in place since 1965 and had been repeatedly upheld as constitutional was no longer constitutional. It exceeded Congress's power. So this kind of decision from the Supreme Court treats Congress kind of as a junior partner when it comes to protecting voting rights. And my amendment, through various technical ways, would change all of that. The other thing that we've seen is, and this has happened in cases that have come from all over the country, including from Wisconsin, a state imposes some kind of voting impediment or restriction. The people who feel that they're aggrieved by it challenge it. And those cases go to the court under something that's called the Anderson-Burdick balancing test. And putting the technicalities aside, what it basically does is it instructs lower courts to put a thumb on the scale favoring the state. So the state just has to posit an interest in preventing fraud or promoting voter confidence. But if plaintiffs want to show a burden, they've got to come up with a ton of evidence to show that they're being seriously burdened in order for this law to be found to be unconstitutional. I would flip this and say, make the states come up with evidence to show that they have a real important reason, supported by actual evidence, to impose barriers on eligible voters. Of course, we need to have some rules in place to assure that our elections are being conducted fairly and with integrity. But a lot of the rules that are put in place are not being done for that reason. They're being done for other reasons, and the courts need to be putting that emphasis on voting rights rather than emphasis on deferring to states.
Rick Hassan is with us talking about his new book. It's called A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. He says the U.S. Constitution needs an amendment that directly guarantees the right to vote. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree? Do you have questions for our guest about how this might work? Concerns about the idea? Coming up, we'll look at what it would take to make that happen. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Rick Hassan, law professor at UCLA, about his new book, A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Rick, before we go to our callers, I want to talk a little bit about how. Now, the way we usually amend the Constitution, which happens rarely, is through the congressional procedure, then ratified by states. Long story short, it would take some serious bipartisan support to make that happen. Could that happen?
Well, first of all, you're right. It's really hard to get a constitutional amendment. The last one we had related to voting was in 1971, making it unconstitutional to discriminate against 18 to 21-year-olds who were being sent off to the Vietnam War. That was 1971, before most Americans were born. We've kind of lost our muscle memory when it comes to passing these things. It requires two-thirds of each House of Congress and three-quarters of the states to agree. So that's really tough. So, you know, why am I even proposing something when Democrats couldn't even pass voting rights legislation the last time they controlled the Congress in 2020 to 2022? Well, I would say we have to have a longer time horizon. So I mentioned the case of Virginia Minor, the woman who went to the Supreme Court in 1874 and asked for the right to vote, being denied her because she was a woman. After that case, when the Supreme Court said it's a matter of state law, we saw a movement that took four decades. It was not until 1920 that the Constitution was amended to provide for the 19th Amendment that bars discrimination in voting on the basis of sex. Along the way, people organized state by state. So by the time we get to 1920, 30 states had reached the point where they had changed their state constitutions to give equal voting rights to women. And so I foresee a similar thing here. We need to organize around voting rights, not be spending every election lurching from crisis to crisis, but instead thinking more long term, being more imaginative about what it would take to have a democracy where we don't have to worry every time we hold an election, whether things are going to be done in a fair way, whether people are going to be disenfranchised, whether there's going to be fraud. I mean, this is just not the way most other democracies do their business.
Let's bring on a caller now. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi. My question is, how would this amendment affect voters who want to vote, but they are felons? Every state is different, but I think of a place like Florida where I think it went to the Supreme Court and they said, yes, felons can vote, but then Florida put up all kinds of obstacles, like you have to pay your fine before you can vote, other obstacles.
Barbara, I gotcha. And Rick, you mentioned that in your baseline, it could be, the language could include non-felons. As Barbara says, each state defines how long that felony affects your voting. You get into Florida and the referendum they had there. How would your proposed amendment affect felons at voting?
So the basic amendment, as we talked about with those six provisions, I would leave things as is, letting it be a state-by-state issue. I think today there are 8 states where felons don't just about automatically get back their voting rights when they complete their sentences. But in the add-ons, where I talk about if we were going to be more imaginative and more protective of democracy, what would we do? I certainly would ban the disenfranchisement of people who've completed their felony sentences. And I do use the example of Florida. In Florida, both Democrats and Republicans, voters voted overwhelmingly for an initiative that did just that, restored the voting rights of people who finished their felony sentences. And then the state legislature came in and they messed with the rules. And today, that amendment is kind of a dead letter. It does not make it easy for people to who had felony sentences to be able to vote. And so rather than letting the political process work it out, the Florida experience convinced me that the better course would be to just eliminate felon disenfranchisement as a permissible category.
Thanks for that call, Barbara. Talking to Rick Hassan about his new book, A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Back to your calls with Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I am with you 100% on the idea of a national ID. I think that would bring us together as a country. I think it's a positive step forward. But my question to you is, how would we incorporate people who live off the grid or who otherwise are American citizens, but they choose not to participate, or the Amish, for example, who are exercising their religious liberty?
Sure. I don't get into much of the detail of this in the book, but the requirement of identification will be coupled with universal voter registration. So each state would have to go out and proactively register all voters, and people will be registered so long as they're eligible for their entire lives. When they move from state to state, because there would be an ID number that would go with them, we'd be able to cancel the registration in one state and add it to the other. Of course, people who have a conscientious objection, they would have to be allowed not to register if they didn't want to. And people who have, for example, a religious objection to being photographed, there would have to be accommodations made for them consistent with First Amendment protections for freedom of religion. But for most people, having this kind of ID would actually be a kind of benefit because, there are all kinds of problems that people face because they don't have a good ID. The difference between what I'm proposing in terms of ID and what exists in some states like Wisconsin is the government would be going out and registering people and helping people get those IDs. So the government would be paying all the costs. If you have to get a birth certificate, you have to otherwise verify who you are. There would be systems in place. So it wouldn't be just a narrow list of IDs. We wouldn't be fighting over whether college student identifications are good enough or anything like that.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. In our last couple of minutes, Rick, I want to talk about your ideas and how they might affect a situation like 2020, where a losing candidate goes through a lot of effort to try to subvert the outcome of the election. How, if your right to vote constitutional amendment had been in place, how might that have gone differently?
Well, first of all, the basis for the fake electors scheme, which I'm sure you've been hearing a lot about in your state, is this idea that state legislatures could somehow swoop in and appoint alternative slates of electors. Now, I believe even under existing law and under the law that existed in 2020, that would be impermissible. But this constitutional amendment would say it in a very clear way. Voters are the ones. So within each state, within Wisconsin, it would be the vote of the voters that would determine which state would get the candidate would get the state's electoral college votes. Similarly, because the Constitution would protect a right to vote and a right to cast a meaningful vote, if there were complaints about software that is potentially being manipulated or election officials who are not doing their job and fairly administering the election, counting the right to vote, voters would have the standing under this amendment to be able to sue and have a federal court examine whether an election is being fairly conducted. So there's something in it for everybody if you want to assure free and fair elections, because it will provide a check on the power of those who run elections to make sure they're doing it fairly. And it would prevent anyone like a state legislature from coming in and trying to disenfranchise voters claiming they have the right to determine the outcome of the election.
Rick, real briefly, you're a big name in election law circles. Are you getting any emails from members of Congress or state lawmakers saying, tell me more, what can we do?
There is some interest, and we'll see. There have been proposals after the 15th Amendment in the 1960s, after 2000. So this issue has come and gone, but maybe now we'll finally get some momentum so we don't go through a crisis every 4 years with our elections.
Rick, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Richard Hasson, professor of law at UCLA, author of the new book, A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. You can keep sharing your thoughts. You can email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.